Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And we're back. We're back again. And not only are we back in like a sense of like we put out a podcast episode, which we've done.
That'd be like in the sense of like Backstreet Boys.
Well, no.
They put out like two songs and they were back for like a month. Maybe.
No, we've been pretty consistent. We dropped an episode every week this year so far. That's six.
Boy, what happens make seven. When you quit your job?
I know. When you can just spend all your time just Googling stuff for hours every day. I have learned so many things since I quit my job and receded from society.
I'm happy for you.
A lot of it is Kabbalah.
Interesting. Okay.
Which we'll talk about very soon. Perfect. I promise. But not today. No, when I say we're back, not only are we back around the sun, not only are we back at this moment in time, but we are back in West Virginia.
Crowley is in West Virginia?
No, we're not talking about that yet.
Oh, man.
I know every time we release an episode that's not Aleister Crowley, I feel the disappointment of a thousand suns crushing me externally. So, yikes. No, we're not talking about Crowley yet. But we are talking about Crowley, and I guarantee that because I've written 10,000 words on the man, and I'm not going to let that go to waste.
Okay.
So we'll get there.
I'm excited for that eventually. But today we're in West Virginia.
We're in West Virginia.
Is this just another episode of Fallout 76? Is that what we're doing?
It's about...
Let's do a Let's Play.
We're going to... Wow.
Fallout 76.
Maybe.
Our monster is in the game.
Is it?
Yeah. So is Mothman.
Really?
Those two things are the only reasons why I ever am interested in that game, even though I know it's totally horrible.
Isn't that the one that's like an online MMORPG?
Yeah, from
and
Bethesda
really
Studios.
Bad.
That's horrible. That's probably the worst title they've made in a decade and a half.
I wish they would just give us Elder
Scrolls. Worse than Skyrim on Alexa. It's apparently a thing.
No, it's not.
It is.
Oh my god.
Anyway.
This is terrible.
So yeah, we could go play the game instead. You want to do that?
No.
Two-player mode?
No, I don't.
All right, well, darn. Anyway, so we're trotting through West Virginia, not in a post-apocalyptic world, but in our very own world.
In our very own world, minus 68 years. Wow, time flies.
I'm like, it was in 52. That's only 50 years ago. Wait a second.
A second here.
2020. Oh, darn it. It strikes again.
I know. It's just...
the worst.
It's just really
okay, so
quite
68
terrible.
Years ago. A long time ago.
68 years ago. On the 15th of September.
Why speak like that?
There were articles that popped up. There were articles that popped up all over the United States. All over the place. And they all honed in on one place. Braxton County, West Virginia. That's how I imagine they speak down there. Now, I've only ever heard the McElroys, and they're from West Virginia, but they don't talk like this at all.
So I would stop that. I'm pretty sure...
Very blunt.
That's quite insulting to someone.
Is it? Who?
It's gotta be.
Who?
Anyone that actually talks like that? And anyone from West Virginia.
If you haven't been able to tell yet, we're talking about a very famous monster of West Virginian folklore. There is only two of them. There is the Mothman, who we talked about last week, of course.
Yeah.
And then this week, we're talking about the Flatwoods Monster of Braxton County, West Virginia.
Which is one that I've been talking about for years.
Flatwoods Monster.
And I don't understand why we took this long to do it.
Because I didn't think there was anything there.
You're right.
I'm not. I'm wrong, actually. This is one of those cases that I was extremely surprised as I kept learning, like, just how much more. I legitimately thought that we could not talk about it for an hour. So not even that, like, there's not enough there from, like, a something happened perspective. There just wasn't enough narrative to cover it. And I was proven quite wrong. I had somebody on Twitter, I can't remember their name, but they... reached out or they replied to a few of my tweets when I was mentioning Flatwoods. I like posted one of the headlines and they were very passionate about letting me know that this was not just like some hicks just not knowing what an owl is. And I was like, all right, this is interesting. And so I kept pulling at that thread and now here we are. ready to talk about it for hopefully just an hour, but it could be more.
It depends on how quickly I defeat you.
That's not how this show works.
I mean, kind of. Why do you have a timer set on your watch there, bud?
I set it for an hour.
Okay. Oh, I'm following.
Because that's how long the episode's supposed
to be. Right, right.
I will say, last week, our total episode length was something like an hour and 45 minutes. And so I cut out 45 minutes of it.
Just every time I spoke, just cut?
No. I cut out the entirety of the Owlman of Cornwall, for one thing. And then I cut out, I think...
So insignificant, I don't even remember
it. And then I think I cut out a few Chinese reports. And I think, I'm not even sure, but I think I cut out the entire Odyssey about the dude getting abducted by the gargoyle. Remember?
Yeah, that was wild.
Yeah, I think I just took that out.
It's probably for the best.
But it's all on the patrons
got
the
whole
hour and 45.
That was also much less Mothman-y.
Yes, exactly.
It was clearly a gargoyle-esque thing.
Exactly. I kind of tried to keep it to the Mothman perspective.
Naturally.
So, but the patrons got the full hour and 45 minutes. But on a typical episode, we're going to try to stay to about an hour. So
we'll see about that.
So let's go.
All right.
Now, the story of the Flatwoods Monster.
Yes.
It is deep with intrigue and many layers.
Stop talking like this.
All right, fine.
Talk normal, please.
On the 12th, 3 days previous to the newspaper headline storm around America, on the 12th, there were two brothers. And this is a very convoluted story, so...
It's wild,
It's
like the Sandlot went to go find an E.T. That's what it reminds me.
That is
actually
quite accurate.
That's what we're going to do. We're all going to grab our baseball bats and we're going to go beat up this alien.
I read multiple accounts.
Ain't going to get us.
And the multiple accounts didn't really differ in anything important, but it did differ in like who was out playing ball and who first saw what and who made it up the hill first and stuff. So I read multiple accounts and then I just streamlined it down into this account. So this...
So you cherry-picked the ones you like the most.
No, based on the multiple sources. Isn't that what we do every week anyway?
Pretty much.
Based on the multiple sources, this is what I believe to be the most coherent, logical series of events. So there are two brothers, Edward and Fred May.
You're getting real close to speaking that accent again, bud.
They were playing football with two friends, Neil Nunley and Tommy Heyer.
That's not enough for a team.
That's only four.
So what, you have the center and then the QB and then...
I don't think they were thinking
they just
like
run?
That. I think they were just...
Are they just tossing the ball?
You're right. The story is full of holes and inconsistencies.
I'm just
it
saying,
doesn't make sense.
It seems like a rough gig.
We have to throw it all out. As is. Now, around 7:15 p.m., they witness an object streak across the sky. The children would later tell... Well, I'll tell you about this guy later, actually. We'll talk about it later. They told somebody...
Wait, did you say what time of day it was?
7:15 p.m.
Okay, I wasn't sure
Thank you.
I missed that or blacked out.
The children would later tell a researcher that what they saw looked like a silver dollar rushing through the sky, spouting red balls of fire behind it. The light came to a stop above a nearby hill, which belonged to their neighbor, G. Bailey Fisher. It hovered there for a moment and then descended. The two boys immediately ran toward... Well, see, now I just said two boys, but there were four of them.
And there's going to be more.
And this is how this sort of thing happens. The four boys immediately ran towards the farm to investigate and stopped by at home to let their mom know what was going on. Those are some well-behaved children.
I mean, there's something going on. Way back in them hills.
Up in them hills.
Gotta let mom know where we're at.
We can't just go by alone.
I got in some serious trouble when I didn't tell mom where I was going.
That's true. And I don't know the ages on these kids, but they're like 12-ish.
They range between, I believe, 9 and 12.
Yeah,
there is one 14-year-old, and then the oldest boy, which we'll get to, is 17, and you have that written down.
Jason, he knows so many things.
I did some background research.
Wow.
Believe it or not.
That's
what happens
not,
when you give me more than 12 hours of time.
That's fair.
I have time to not only read through your notes, but also find out more information.
Well, all right. Now, their mom was named Kathleen. Kathleen insisted upon going with them, which is a power move from Kathleen.
Cool mom.
Is a cool mom. She could have just said, that's ridiculous. There is no silver dollar flying saucer in the sky. Landed on neighbor Fisher's yard.
So, wait, hold on a second. You roll up, and you're like, Mom, we just saw a UFO crash or land or mm-hmm. something. We're going to go investigate. Mom's like, cool, I'll get my camera. Let's go.
Yeah, that's a cool mom.
That sounds horrible.
Why does that sound horrible?
Mom, are you prepared?
To what? Come in contact with the unknown?
Yes! I would not have been prepared. I'd be like, oh, well, let's go get your brother. My brother, I meant. Never mind. I'm done here.
Okay.
We're gonna wrap this up now.
So Kathleen May is a cool mom. That's what we've done here. And she insisted upon
going
with them.
Cool, supportive mom.
Yes. Which I'm sure they as kids were like, ugh, Mom, why do you have to come with us to everything? We're 12 years old. We could do things. But she cared about her children. So she also brought a National Guardsman. A 17-year-old named Gene Lemon. Now, in your background research, could you figure out who this guy was or why they had such quick access to him?
Eugene Lemon?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I just thought it was incredibly strange that... Well, I'm assuming like he's actually just, like, a kid from the block. He's 17.
Gene from the block.
That's what I'm assuming. Yeah. It's a small town.
Yeah.
And he's probably the most, like, quote-unquote qualified... He may have been like a scout or something at one point. You never know.
Probably.
But no, I didn't look into Gene. I just thought it was really weird that the National Guard had a 17-year-old in their ranks.
Yeah. That was strange.
Which I don't think you can do unless you have like parental permission.
Yeah.
In order to sign up at that point. But maybe that was different back in the 50s. I don't know.
Back in the good old days.
Anyway, I just thought it was weird that a 17-year-old kid was also in the National Guard. So we'll go from there.
Yeah. Now, they made their way to the farm. And they picked up another local neighborhood boy named Ronnie Shaver.
Hey, Ronnie. We're going to go check out the UFO that just crashed.
We're going to go see the aliens, Ron.
I'm like, oh, gee willikers, that sounds like fun. I'll go too.
This
What?
This brought the number of human beings up to 7.
It's like gathering the gang from New York gangs.
It's very... You mean gangs of New York?
That's what I meant. See, this is what happens.
Who can forget Martin Scorsese's classic New York Gangs?
Stop making me wake up early on my days off, okay?
It's 10 a.m., Jason.
On my day. I was up at 7:30. I wanted to sleep in.
That was not my fault.
I had to make breakfast.
You didn't have to spend an hour and a half making breakfast.
It was a beautiful
only
breakfast.
To be late by 20 minutes. You didn't have to do that. You did that. Now, there was also one dog with them. As well. The dog is not named, which is a tragedy.
It is.
Of course, dogs...
It's probably my favorite character.
Dogs never quite fare well in these stories, so maybe it's best that we don't name it. But they approach the farm. The dog runs up the hill. Let's just name him.
This is a motley crew we've got.
We'll name the dog Motley. That's a great name for the dog.
Okay.
I like that. So Motley runs up the hill, and then he comes back whimpering. Just a few minutes later... The gang begins their ascent and notices something odd right off the bat. There's a pungent mist that's accompanied by a smell that seems to be metallic and was nauseating to everyone involved. Now, the mist had appeared a little bit before the top of the hill, but became more pungent and thick as they ascended. Now, upon reaching the crest of the hill on Fisher Farm, they saw a pulsing red light. Some reports stated that the light was coming from a ball of fire about 50 feet to their right. According to the Barker interviews, Gray Barker being the person who interviewed the children first after the event, which we'll talk about a little more. You may recognize that name, or you may not. But according to the Barker interviews, some members of the group claimed that it was as big as a house. They all felt enraptured by the light and didn't realize that there was something just 15 feet to their left. They first noticed it as two glowing spots hovering in the middle of the air. Now, Lemon, the National Guardsman, shined his flashlight towards the pair of eyes that had appeared in the darkness, and the light fell upon a monster. The height of the being was between 10 to 12 feet tall. One of the first things they noticed, the most striking, which according to Gray Barker was reported similarly by separated witnesses, was the shape of the creature's head and its terrible face. The face itself was round and blood red. It had two eyes, or at least two eye-like openings, which were orangish circles the size of silver half dollars. These had drawn the group's attention. But out of the eyes seemed to come beams, which were projected over their heads. And surrounding the round head was a sort of cowl or a hood, which came to a point looking very much like an ace of spades, is how it was traditionally described. Now, the cowl appeared to have some sort of embedded flickering lights. The hands of the beast were small and clawed. There were no apparent feet or legs, just the monster hovering in midair. And the smell that had been with them, carried on the dark mist, became overpowering. It smelled like metal and burning sulfur. Upon being sighted, the monster made a sound that witnesses described as being between a hiss, and a high-pitched squeal, and a thumping, throbbing noise. It began to move towards them, and according to Neil Nunley, when asked how the thing moved, he said, quote, "I couldn't move as it did. It just moved. It didn't walk. It moved evenly. It didn't jump," unquote. While it was moving towards them, it seemed to be moving in a sort of circular or arch-like way, as though intending to get around the group to make it to the light off to their right. It was at this point that the group fled the scene. And the group decided it was time to take their leave, evidenced by the plain fact that Mr. Lemon, the 17-year-old National Guardsman, fainted and dropped his flashlight. So they had to pick up their fallen comrade and hightail it home. Upon returning home, the group realized that there was something seriously wrong with them. All seven of them were afflicted with some combination of throat swelling, vomiting, and nausea. Lemon himself even had like contractions, like seizure-like symptoms afterwards. They called the police to report the sighting, only to be told, interestingly enough, that the cops were already investigating reports of a downed aircraft in that area. But they were unable to find anything at all. Jason, that's the initial sighting of the monster.
Okay.
There's not a lot of monster sightings in this one.
There isn't. That is the primary.
That's the centerpiece. That's the delicious wedding cake that you paid $800 for, and then you can't even remember what it tastes like.
Perfect. I'm going to cut it up and put it in your face.
What's it do to you?
It does absolutely nothing.
Damn it.
So, you did make a
Let me say. If you say it's an owl, I'm going to stab you in the eye. Go ahead.
I'm going to take your pencil from you first. Do. It was probably an owl. Now, here's the thing. You put together a really great narrative.
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Now, the problem is that the only consistent thing with everyone's retelling of what happened is the fact that the head and essentially the upper torso was the only thing that was consistent between all the accounts. As far as any body size goes or shape like that, I do know that Mrs. May said that there was some sort of like folds underneath the torso area.
Like a pleated skirt.
Correct. But she was the only one that said anything like that. She was also the only one to describe claws of some sort to it. Mm. Terrible claws as well.
Awful. Terrible claws.
Yes. And secondly, they did not have a lot of time that they actually looked at it.
Yes.
Eugene probably shined the light on it within about a second to two before dropping it and being just terrified. He was even not able to really speak much on their way back home. You want me to continue?
Yeah, keep going. I'm listening.
Okay, so as far as the aircraft part, You want me to start taking that we'll apart?
Get
we'll get to that.
No, the aircraft's okay. Important. So, okay.
Second thing.
So, firstly, you think it's an owl again.
I always think it's
how
an owl.
How unique. How refreshing.
I mean, Wikipedia is rarely wrong. And if you go to the Flatwood Monster Wikipedia page, under conventional explanations, the first thing is barn owl. And I learned some really interesting things about barn owls.
Please tell me. I'm dying to know.
One thing is that the female barn owl is actually larger than the male barn owl. And most barn owls, when you look, or if it's a male barn owl, actually has a more white face to it, while the females have a, kind of a more tan or tawny color to them, which would kind of more closely match the red face that they describe, especially when you get some of the light shine off of it. Birds are typically known for a red eye shine. Also, one really cool thing about barn owls is that they don't actually nest like normal birds. They don't make nests. They actually brood their young in hollow trees. That hill in particular had a lot of oak trees, which are famous for being hollow. There's a very good chance that she was potentially brooding young still, which is why she didn't just fly away, but instead sat there looking menacingly and then swooped towards them as a defensive mechanism when they did not leave. Because the movement sounds like a bird's flight of path. As far as the fog goes, the police do say that a fog was rolling over the hill by that evening anyway. And apparently there's a weird species of grass that lives in that county that does, if you do get close to it, smell kind of metallic and gross.
God makes some gross grass.
It is found in multiple places in the county. When it comes to the nausea, they were scared out of their minds when they actually found something when they went to go look for aliens. These are 10, 12, and 14-year-olds
and an
primarily.
Adult.
And an adult.
17-year-old National Guardsman. How
who
dare
dropped
you
the
disrespect
flashlight
him.
And had the worst reaction.
He was very scared.
He got very, very scared.
Poor Gene Lemon.
And I'll get to the spaceship later.
Okay. So that's what Jason thinks. How predictable. Sad. However,
I got a video for you later.
However, the story
continues.
The story
is a story.
Does not end there. Within an hour or so, Lemon, probably hoping to prove himself somehow, returned to the scene, accompanied by the publisher of the Braxton County Democrat, a local paper, by the name of A.L. Stewart. That was weirdly phrased. The guy's name was A.L. Stewart, and he is the publisher of the Braxton County Democrat. There was also a number of men armed with shotguns. Now, the posse was unable to locate the monster, but all of them reported a sickening odor and recognized a strange change in temperature, with the top of the hill being significantly warmer than elsewhere. Regarding the odor, Stewart, who had been in the Air Force, claimed to have never smelled anything quite like it, a statement later echoed by the witnesses themselves. The next morning, the group, again accompanied by Stewart, returned to the hilltop where they discovered skid marks filled with some sort of black, goopy liquid. The marks seemed to indicate movement from where the monster was reported towards the shining fireball of light. Interestingly enough, the grandmother of the Mays boys remembered that when she saw her daughter later that night, her children had black oil on their face, her grandchildren did, and she wiped it off for them.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. Thanks. Do you want to say why that's interesting now, or do you want to keep it for later?
I don't know. You got more to talk about with the oil and the tracks?
Nope, that's about it for that one.
Perfect. Because a young man at the time named Max Lockhart also heard about the strange events up at the hill and decided to drive his 42 Chevy truck up to see if he can have a look around and see what was going on. His truck made the skid marks. It also planted the rubbery oil.
Allegedly. Allegedly.
He himself has said that.
Yeah, well, when we were watching, when we were going over the freaking, the Rendlesham Forest case, there were people who said that the lights in the sky were caused by practical jokers with flashlights. Sometimes people just say things because they want to be famous or infamous in some way. So, can he prove it?
I mean, we had photos of the 42 Chevy that he owned.
Yes, and I can take a picture of a car.
No one took pictures of the skid marks.
Yeah, so we can't prove it. This is just hearsay, Your Honor. And I request an injunction.
Okay, also, those lights, those burning beacons, were actually aircraft beacons on top of the hill so planes don't run into it. Because the size also varied depending on who was telling the story. And they never got close enough to actually see it.
What beacon? You're talking about the monster itself?
No, there are three the fireballs in the forest that it's next to. There are three orange aircraft beacons on the top of the hill so that the planes don't crash into it. That was stated by a resident of that area.
Now, the swelling and the irritation of the throats got worse until the children couldn't even drink water, which is totally something that happens when you just smell some weird grass.
It is something that happens when you are panicking from fright.
A doctor who was called to assist the battered group claimed that their symptoms were similar to those that he had seen during the war of soldiers who had been doused with mustard gas. The family went to sleep for the night, or at least they tried to. And according to the reports of a married couple, one Donna and William Smith of the Citizen Saucer Investigation Group, based out of California.
They've got nothing to... nothing to prove.
A number of other residents of Braxton County had also seen a number of bizarre things before and after the run-in with the monster. Their investigation was made to either confirm or deny the accounts of what was told to Gray Barker. So like I had mentioned, Gray Barker is the first researcher to jump on the case. As soon as he hears about this through the paper, he's on his way. He's there, basically, already. Barker is an interesting figure. It is he who wrote the seminal work They Knew Too Much About UFOs, which is the basis of the legend or the reports of the Men in Black. Barker was also intimately involved in the Mothman investigation itself, but this was his first real claim to fame. He wrote a piece, I can't remember what it was called. It was for Fate magazine, and it was just him going and taking the accounts of all of this, him correlating all of these accounts and creating the narrative, which is important for telling stories. Everything's a narrative. And then he goes on from there to become very prominent in the UFO community. Now, the only problem with Gray Barker is that
he's pro-UFO?
No, not even that.
Oh, that's not a problem.
Because that's not a problem. That's just an attitude, an idea. The
a
problem,
bias.
Sure.
Some would say.
Sure.
Some being me.
As if you, Jason, have no biases at all.
Hey, man, just because I think owls are cool.
he's pro-owl. Well, there's a police siren, and I think they're coming to arrest Jason. I hope so, because I called the cops on him while he wasn't looking.
Weird. It's like you should have done that with a downed UFO instead of going exploring.
They did call
kids.
The cops on the UFO. They just wanted to make
After
sure.
After the fact.
They just wanted to make sure they weren't wasting the cops' time.
They just wanted to check it out so they didn't have all that tape to get around.
Gray Barker is...
Later at the scene.
Gray Barker is a controversial figure because he's been known to hoax things. So,
interesting.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that this is a hoax. And in fact, like I said...
It shouldn't be thrown out whatsoever. It should be truth.
Donna and William Smith... their whole point of being there was to either confirm or deny what people told Gray. They went and they interviewed the same people, same area. It's a very, very small town. They basically tried to interview everybody in it. And they confirmed that at least what Gray had been told was, or what he had reported was what he had been told. Now, One such witness that they uncovered in their investigation was the director of the Board of Education for the area. The next morning on September 13th at 6:30 a.m., this man saw a saucer take off not far from his house. There was also a report from Lemon's mother that around 7:15, she was having a cup of coffee when the house rumbled with a terrifying intensity. Their coffee spilled, the radio turned off by itself and wouldn't come on for 45 minutes, at which point it turned itself back on. And finally, another witness, a 21-year-old woman who was hospitalized about 11 miles away from Flatwoods, claimed to have seen the same figure while she was on her way to church with her mother. Basically, they were driving. The thing appeared in the middle of the road, flooded the car with light. They both fell victim to the same foul gas, describing it the exact same way. And the girl was hospitalized with similar symptoms as those experienced by the May group. This occurred a week before the sighting on Fisher's Hill. So the girl was hospitalized at the time of the sighting. She was already in the hospital at that point. So then, there's that.
So then it has no consistencies with the actual story. So this is just...
She saw the same figure and smelled the same smells, and then she was hospitalized, having the similar conditions.
Right. But in our story,
right,
it's a downed craft.
Theoretically. That doesn't mean that it couldn't have been in the area taking soil samples or whatever before. It's definitely not in the official narrative. There is no official narrative. It's definitely not in the narrative that, yes, this only time that this monster was in the area was that night.
Correct.
But it could be that the monster was in the area for some time, especially checking things out. Soil samples, flora and fauna reports, as the aliens are wont to do for whatever reason. I'm just telling it like it is.
Okay.
All right, so The bigger picture. Another researcher comes to town, this one, to investigate the events of the 12th as well. He was the most well-respected of all of the investigators, with Barker, like we said, being a virtual unknown at the time, and the Smiths being absolutely non-entities apart from this event. Now, this man's name was Ivan T. Sanderson, and he is essentially... to cryptozoology, what J. Allen Hynek is to UFOs. He invented the term cryptozoology.
He's an interesting fellow.
He is. What did you learn about him?
He popularized the Yeti.
Hell yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
That is cool.
I also learned he died of cancer in 73 in New Jersey.
Sad. Probably all the cigarettes.
That would make sense if that's the case.
I'm just assuming it's 1952.
I do know
smoked.
You have more background information about the man, so I'll let you dive into that.
Oh, you sure?
Absolutely.
Okay. Ivan T. Sanderson. He held degrees in zoology, botany, and ethnology. At the age of 13, when Sanderson was 13, his father, who was not 13, was killed by a rhinoceros. After graduating with honors from Cambridge, he began traveling to pursue his passions of biology and zoology.
Oh, Scotland native as well.
Yes.
American naturalized.
Yes. All the best people come from Scotland, I've found. That's another one of my biases.
You can keep going.
Now, when the war broke out, he was a spy in the Caribbean. One heck of a guy. Yeah.
Counter-espionage.
Yeah, that's a spy.
Yeah.
If you're in espionage at all, you're either a spy or a spy master. Through his interviewing of literally everybody in the town and the surrounding area, which is a number estimated at around 300 people, Sanderson came to the conclusion that there was not only one object seen shortly after 7 p.m. rushing through the air, but instead there were five distinct objects, three of which crashed, one of which disintegrated into the air, and one of which traveled eastwards. Furthermore, he confirmed, for the third time, what Barker had been told. Again, it's impossible to go back in time to see it yourself, but he was able to say, yes, I was told the same things. Sanderson's reports were picked up by a newspaper or by local newspapers around the nation, lending an air of credibility to the sightings, as Sanderson's expert opinion was that the reports were not the wild, raucous affair that had been reported to the newspaper. So the newspapers said things like, basically, as one might expect, they lampooned the thing from the start. They
what?
Talked about it being anywhere from 8 to 17 feet tall.
Yep.
It was fire breathing. It was a dragon. It was all sorts of different things that, as far as I can tell, were never said. But I have a bias. So who knows? In any case.
The problem is that we have testimonies from like 7 different people.
Yes.
And the majority of those testimonies don't match up with each other.
Sure.
Which happens a lot when you are scared and trying to remember things, especially for young people.
True.
It's tough to remember when you're panicking. Details get lost. Okay.
Reports of other airborne objects flooded in from around the surrounding area, and they were published the same morning as the Flatwood story, thus precluding any possibility that they were influenced by the story itself. Yet the scale of the sightings on a geographical sense seems to disprove such a theory anyways. Because if it was just other people in Flatwoods or even just in the area saying, yeah, I saw all these weird lights in the sky, even if it happened before the story was published on a large scale, it's still possible that people talk, they hear things, and it's like whatever. However, it was not just residents of Flatwoods that witnessed objects in the sky that night. It was not even just those in West Virginia. Reports came in from Normal, Virginia, also just known as Virginia, Maryland, Tennessee, South Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. And the reports are strange. Most of the reports painted the lights in the sky as simply meteorites or shooting stars. One estimation, by the direction of the Fells Planetarium, claimed that the object was up high in the atmosphere, no bigger than the size of a pea. However, this report was prompted by the fact that people reported it as a plane crash. In Ohio, similar reports of a burning plane crashing to Earth came flooding in. But the strangest one of all, in my opinion, came from North Carolina, where the object was reported as starting out red, then turning white as it approached the Earth. A witness saw it land about 1,000 feet away with apparently no sound and white light streaming through a thicket of trees before it finally disappeared. When a party was rallied to go search for survivors of what they were sure was a plane crash, there was not even any debris found. Again, that one was in North Carolina. Other reports from different parts of the country straight up claimed that they were simply UFOs, flying saucers, and that there was a large amount of them from all over. Either way, people saw lights in the sky, and those lights seemed to come down to Earth. The time of the reports were almost universally between 7 and 8 p.m. that evening in those, I want to say it's 6, maybe it was 7 different states. It is Sam here. I just wanted to go ahead and do a real quick mid-show break. We don't have any other podcasts to plug today. So like I said, it'll be pretty quick. Feel free, if you're a listener or you know a great podcast or you are a great podcast or whatever, and you want to look at doing some cross-promotion with us, you can send that to notalonepodcast@gmail.com. Let me know. We're always looking for great shows to plug during our mid-show break. But today, we are just going to focus on the thank yous. So we want to thank everyone who's become a patron in the last little bit of time. We didn't do it last week just because we didn't have a lot. I think we only had one or two, and now we've got a little bit more. So sometimes that might happen. But before I thank all these wonderful people, I'd just like to remind everyone that if we can get up to 150 patrons, that's 45 more than we have now. And I know that's a lot. It's literally like another third or another half on top of what we already have. But if we can get up to 150 patrons before March 20th, which is when I'm going to start officially packing my bags for our big move to Washington, Me and Jason will go check out like a haunted graveyard or something around Boise, and we'll record it and do it all ghost hunter style. So just keep that in mind, spread the word. But we want to go ahead and thank a few wonderful people who have decided to become our patrons over on patreon.com. And those wonderful people are Andrew and his wife, Rosie. We'd also like to thank Emily, Gunner, Diego, Tomas, and Jungle Clams. Guys, thank you all so much for becoming a patron. It means the world to us. Again, you can head over to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn how you can get more content from the show, in addition to just helping us out and supporting us. So thank you so much. Another wonderful way of supporting the show, of course, is to write us an iTunes review. And we've had a few of these come in the last few weeks, which is fantastic. They had kind of stalled out for a time. But we would like to thank, and I don't know where we stopped, so we'll go back a bit. You might get double think. We'll see. We'd like to thank Shibunji, Lou Cipher 85, 3 Metric Tons of Cabbage, Foxwork, and Kiwi 347. And I would like to go ahead and read out Foxworks. They say top PNW, which of course, if you're not in the know, means Pacific Northwest, podcast. This is honestly one of my favorite podcasts. I am a PNW native, and while I was in the Midwest for grad school, this pod got me through. It was like hanging with my nerd buddies around the D&D table. The substitute for my dude friends back home filled my heart with happiness and kept the loneliness away while I was at school. The subject matter is wonderful, and I love the casual, friendly nature of the pod. You have a forever fan in me. Thank you so much for that wonderful review, and thank you to everyone who has written a review or become a patron on Patreon. And if you can't do either one of those things, we totally understand. Just tell a friend. Share the good word of Not Alone Podcast. Anyway, we'll get back to the show now, and you can hear me just totally have the end of my patience with Jason on his blatant UFO denial. And here we go. So, Jason, you want to talk about the lights in the sky?
Sure. It's a well-known fact that a meteor streaked across the sky on the eastern seaboard.
Okay.
Astronomers in Baltimore clocked it in Maryland there in the same trajectory as Flatwoods itself.
Yeah.
And as you said in the very beginning of that, most people saw it as a meteor. And that's exactly what it was. Now,
except for the people who saw it crash to the Earth.
Right, which is caused by an optical illusion because it's dashing behind a hillside out
coming
of our point of view.
Coming to rest in a thicket of trees with light streaming out from that thicket for a period of time.
But there was no crash site.
Correct.
There was
because it was
no
an alien.
So, if it hoots like an owl,
it doesn't.
Probably
if
an
it
owl.
Lands like a flying saucer. It's probably a flying saucer.
Flying saucers can't land in a thicket of trees without moving trees.
Sure they can. Sure they can. Now the following day...
This is who I have to deal with.
This is who I have to deal with. George and Edith Snidowski. They were driving near Braxton County when their car died. Their car was then filled with a foul, sulfurous smell, and their child, an 18-month-old son, began crying. Then the car was flooded with light, and the silhouette of a figure about 10 feet tall appeared in front of the car. Notably, the figure was not wearing an Ace of Spades-type cowl, but instead, its head was described as reptilian and bony. Its hands were clawed, and it floated. The monster stayed for only a few moments, and then it floated away into the woods. Once it was gone, the car started, and the Snitkowskis gunned it home. By the time the newspaper articles came out 2 days later, the descriptions of the creatures had varied. According to one article in the Oakland Tribune under the headline, "Eek, what was that red-faced monster scene?" which is the OG clickbait.
Did they even describe it as having a red face? All the descriptions said it was reptilian-like, right?
No, so the it varies again. Perfect. The official one that Barker collected and then everybody else confirmed didn't say much about the face of the monster seen on top of the hill at all, other than it just had the two
big eyes
and the Ace of Spades cowl.
Correct.
Which, what is that?
You really want me to?
We'll get to it.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Because I am being punished for something I did at one point in
my
life, I'm sure.
You know, it's funny, though, is that this story reminded me of something I watched as a kid, which I think was like, I'm not going to say Animal X, but like another one of those like weird history ancient alien things. It was like Animal Mystery X or something like that. I don't know, man.
Such a cool
name. It was pretty cool. But that's how they described the Flatwoods Monster, which is why I wanted to do this forever. But it sounds like a reptilian Mr. like Grouch in a trash can floating around. That's how they described it a lot. Now, that description is the one that kind of stuck with one of the reporters. Was it Barker in general? Where that was more the predominant...
Was what, the reptilian?
Yeah. The predominant portrait of it or something. I know that portrayal was not at all in sync with what the original description was on the hillside.
Yeah.
So to me, that this seems like a completely its own incident in general.
Yes.
Its own thing.
It was just floating, and it had the weird smell.
I feel like it did. It deserves its own I'm a monster from somewhere else. Not this one.
All right.
He's
we'll
taking
give it,
credit for
do
what
you
want to
name it?
No.
You discovered it. That's how it works.
Floating Reptile Trash Can Man.
Okay. Floating Reptile Trash Can Man. Maybe we'll do a series on that.
Nope. This is it. That's the only
this
thing we got.
So that report in the paper in the Oakland Tribune said, quote, police said eyewitnesses guess as to the monster's height varied from 7 to 17 feet. Mrs. May said a fire-breathing monster, 10 foot tall, with a bright green body and a blood-red face, bounced and floated towards them. According to another article in the Brownwood Bulletin, quote, Lemon said he thought it was a possum or a coon until he put his flashlight on the thing. It was then that he saw the monster with the blussying face, which is not a word that I was able to find in a dictionary, but I read it in the paper, in the scan
really?
Of the paper itself. That's the word.
Did they not
blussying.
Just screw up and do like blushing face?
Could be.
Because it was described as being red,
yes,
right?
Yes, but it is
blussing.
This is something I saw with my own two eyes. And green body that seemed to glow. Unquote. The main takeaway, the soundbite read round the nation, was Kathleen May claiming that the monster looked worse than Frankenstein. It was determined by both Barker and Sanderson that the reporting around the incident was highly irresponsible, biased, and convoluted from the start.
Agreed.
Portraits of the community being highly divided and mocking the witnesses mercilessly seemed to be groundless. Equally groundless were the claims of the 17-foot-tall beings that were half-man, half-dragon, breathing fire.
Agreed.
Now, you just think that because all of this is baseless.
I mean, a 17-foot-tall, half-man, half-dragon thing does not go unnoticed.
That's true. I remember when I saw my first 17-foot-tall, half-dragon, half-man thing. I noticed it.
That's what I'm getting at.
While the monster would not appear in Flatwoods, there is still much more to this story. Most of it, however, takes place before the actual sighting and has to do with the strange things that people saw all over the world. And by all over the world, I mean primarily in Florida, leading up to the event. It's basically just Florida.
It's only Florida. It's Florida.
It's Florida. Now, a month before the Flatwood event, on August 19th, 1952, in West Palm Beach, Florida, there was a scoutmaster by the name of D.S. DeVerges, who was driving three of his scouts home. At night, I don't know what time, when he noticed a bright light coming through a thicket of ferns. There's a lot of lights coming through thickets in this episode. I'm all about it. I love it.
Lights.
It's my aesthetic.
From a place.
from thickets.
Through thickets.
Desverges was concerned, because of the intensity of the light, that it could be indicative of a fire or even a downed aircraft. But Desverges, who goes by Sunny, pulled over and jumped out of the car. He told the kids that he was with that if he wasn't back in 30 minutes, they had to go get help. How they were supposed to get help? Because presumably none of them
could
drive.
Old were these, how old were
they
these
were
children?
Kids. I don't know how old.
I mean, 50s, Florida, rural.
You could drive
a car. I was driving my dad's little pickup around our orchard at 10.
At 10?
I had a go-kart at like 10 as well, so...
This is wild. The first time I ever drove a car, I was 12, I think. I drove it down a street and back. Not even a street. It was in the desert.
I was just driving through our orchard, so.
So worst case scenario, you hit a tree and you die.
It was on private land, and I was going like 5 miles an hour.
Once he had made it about 50 yards into the thicket, Sonny smelled a smell. A smelly smell that smelled. An offensive odor. A metallic odor that he almost couldn't stand. Now, he used a machete to clear the brush, which he had. He held a flashlight in the other hand. And it's worth pointing out that he had a second flashlight ready to go.
Wait a second. He had a machete.
Yeah.
And a flashlight.
Yeah.
And if he wasn't back in half an hour, he told the kids to go get help.
Yeah.
What was he so afraid of
with a machete? Does this not sound like Florida to you?
It does, actually. Yeah. You're right. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if he found a kangaroo.
And he had to kill it. He turned a signal back to the car. And when he did, he was overcome by an intense heat. He looked up and saw a great object blocking out the light from the stars above him. Once his eyes had adjusted to the darkness, he was able to make out an oval-shaped object about 30 feet above him. He shined his flashlight towards it and saw a concave metal bottom and a round dome on top. He began to back away slowly when he found himself enveloped.
How was he able to see the top? It was above him.
I don't know. Probably above to like the side. I don't know. He did, though.
All right.
And he backed away slowly.
If he says so.
And he found himself enveloped in a thick mist. The smell increased in potency, and he heard the sound of a metal door opening. And then he passed out. The three boys in the car saw a big red ball of fire shoot up from the general area they had seen their scoutmaster signal from. They immediately tried to make good on their mission to find help. Help came in the form of a farmer, who called the cops for the kids. The cops arrived very shortly after and took the kids back to where Sonny disappeared from. And as they pulled up to the area, Sonny came screaming, running out of the woods. The deputy sheriff, a man named Mott, the guy with the apple juice, Mott's apple juice, Mott Parton, deputy sheriff.
So the career change was very beneficial for him.
Yes. He said he had never seen anyone as scared as Desvergers was. And Sonny was burned, sunburned, freshly sunburned at night.
So he got exposed to UV rays?
He was sunburned at night.
So he got exposed to UV rays?
Where do UV rays come from?
Typically the sun.
Yep.
But they can be produced by other lights.
Like what lights? Like a big ball of fire?
I don't know. Probably not fire.
Seen shooting up?
That's mostly like heat radiation.
Uh-huh.
I don't think that causes UV.
Okay.
I don't know. I have a UV light for Rocco. All I'm saying is that sunburns are caused by UV rays.
Okay.
The sun doesn't technically have to be out to get a sunburn.
Yeah, okay.
And it's not the light from the sun that does it. It's the UV rays.
Right. So, like, I don't know, a UFO could cause this?
I don't know.
That seems to be the story.
UFOs
Unless you can tell me what else was in a thicket...
Light rays.
...at night causing sunburns.
Well, I mean, the ball of fire makes some sense with all the will-o-wisp things that we've talked about in the past and just... fumes.
Because it's not because swamp gas doesn't do it, does it?
UV? I wouldn't expect it to. Because, like, for example, if a house is on fire, firefighters don't get sunburnt. People don't get sunburnt from being around fires at a campfire, right? So it's a different kind of light that gets emitted. UV rays just aren't visible to us, so that makes more sense. All descriptions of UFOs typically just have normal lights on them within our visual light spectrum, not outside of it.
Well, UV lights are outside of our spectrum, aren't they? Isn't that the point? And so even if it was emitting normal light that we can see, it could also be emitting UV light.
Potentially.
Because that's what the sun does.
Yeah, but if you're emitting UV light, so say if our aliens were using some sort of UV, their eyesight picks up a different spectrum than what we do.
Okay.
Thus, all they have to emit is UV light for them to be able to see.
Okay.
But we would not be able to see it, and there's no reason why they'd have other lights on their craft.
Well, that's good news.
Visible in our spectrum.
That's good news, because when he saw it, at least, there weren't other lights on the craft. It was just dark.
But they saw a light through the thicket.
That's true.
So what I'm getting at is that, hypothetically, if our aliens see in a different light spectrum, which is why they need the UV light.
This is just the same question as always, which is, why do UFOs have lights?
Why do UFOs have lights?
And it's to signal us, because they want us to engage.
Absolutely no reason to have a UV light, and yet, unless you are using it for things like how Rocco needs it.
Right.
In order to metabolize stuff.
Right.
In his body. Or if, I don't know, you want to give everyone sunburns. There's no actual reason to have a light to emit UV.
Yes. Which, again, takes me back to the original question of how did he get UV burns.
The light is the lure, is what you're telling me.
Yes, that's what it is. We are dumb fish drawn in by shiny lights.
And then they just blast us with UV a little bit too hot, so we can't get tan, but we get burned instead.
Just to do it. Yeah, had to do it.
That seems really malicious in order to travel across space to do that.
Yeah. Well, when you're eternal, you get bored. When you're immortal, you've got a lot of time on your hands to do stuff like punk the kids, punk the fish.
My assumption is that it was something else entirely and not a sunburn.
Hmm. Now,
from the descriptions that we have later,
the cops came back to this area. They found an indentation in the ground, and they found one of Sonny's two flashlights. But the second flashlight was never found. I don't know about the machete, they didn't say. In the following days, Sonny would be examined by an Air Force surgeon who confirmed that it was in fact a recent sunburn, and his arms and hair had also been singed. His nostrils on the inside were burned by a flash heat source, and the earth and ground were also scorched in an oval pattern. Quote, though the soil remained consistent, the root structure of the plants in question was charred black, and the lower leaves had deteriorated as if by heat. The only way the lab could come close to duplicating this effect was to place live clumps of grass in a pan of sandy soil and heat it to about 300 degrees Fahrenheit, unquote. Finally, Sonny's cap was also burned, and the three scouts confirmed that the cap had not been burned when he went into the woods. Edward J. Ruppelt, who you might remember is the original head of Project Blue Book, took the account down as authentic and unexplainable. And less than 1 month later, the same fireball appearance, smell, mist, and heat were reported by seven people on top of a hill in Flatwoods, West Virginia.
But it was coming from the other direction. It wasn't coming from Florida. It came from the north.
That one did.
Northeast, specifically.
Sure. Yeah, sure, that one did.
We didn't have any singeing at the crash and or landing site.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Again, it sounds like a completely different
it's
scenario.
It's not, though. It can't be.
It can be.
Now,
it just sounds like he was exposed to some sort of blast of heat from something.
Yeah, a UFO.
I don't know. If you guys actually think it's connected to one and the same, then cool.
I do. But here's the thing.
I think, Sam, you're just grasping at straws. I don't think they're at all tangled together.
All right. Well, and here's the thing about it, is that 1952 was a banner year for UFO activity.
Well, here's the thing about that.
Tell
the
me.
The 50s in general was UFO craze.
Yeah, but 1952
everything
was like,
about aliens.
Yes, but
everything.
Yes, but 1952 was like the biggest time. It's what
Sam,
prompted.
Are you trying to tell me pop culture doesn't influence
Project Blue Book.
What people see?
No, not at all. I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
No, I'm not
saying that at all. That is exactly what I am saying. Is that pop culture will change what you perceive.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Which is why we have an increase of UFO sightings during this time.
Yes, but 1952 was the peak of it, is what I'm saying.
Perfect.
That's all I'm saying.
Awesome.
That was the year that UFOs were sighted over Washington, D.C. We talked about that
all
in
our Project
Blue Book
All I'm saying is that aliens and UFOs were like zombies back in 2010. Everywhere. You could not escape them.
Yeah, but
horrible
you didn't see people.
Got written for
them. Yeah, but people didn't claim that they saw zombies.
Well, no, because
they
we're
knew
slightly
it was
smarter
science.
Than that.
They knew it was fiction,
right? But it's fun to think about, and they weren't 10.
Are you saying that the only people who report UFOs are 10-year-olds? Because if so, you are vastly mistaken.
I'm saying that we have a group of children.
No! We're not even talking about the kids.
No, I am.
We are zooming out. Zooming large far
profile.
Out. There was a substantial amount of UFO activity in 1972, especially in the summertime, but the thing of it came to a head between July 19th and 29th of that year. You see, on the night of the 19th, radar operators at Washington National Airport noted objects of unknown origin that began traveling at about 100 to 130 miles per hour, headed towards Washington, D.C., but periodically would accelerate to above 7,200 miles per hour, or 2 miles a second.
Now that is an interesting statistic.
And we've already talked about it. It's in our Project Blue Book episodes, so, which you should absolutely go back and listen to.
I looked into that a little bit more. Just in general, because I was curious about just how fast that is, right?
Yeah.
The fastest craft on record travels 2.6 miles a second.
No.
Yes.
What?
And that was in 1967. It literally looks just like a rocket ship.
Wow.
It's literally just a rocket, and it has a cockpit on it. That's all it is. The X-15, which is wild. But yes, it travels at Mach 6.7.
Dang.
That holds the speed record for a manned aircraft. Which
20 some years later.
In 67, yeah.
So 15 years later.
Which is incredible.
That is
so
incredible.
To give you an idea of like how fast that is, we have barely made something faster than what that thing was traveling at.
Yeah. It's crazy. That's crazy. And it's amazing.
I love it. It's very cool. It looks like a bottled rocket, or it looks just like a homemade rocket that you'd get at like Michael's or something. And it just has a cockpit in it, and it's gigantic.
That's insane. I love it.
And then I'm assuming we just decided that it was useless to spend money on things going this fast or faster, and then we just stopped
when
making
has
fast
that,
things.
When has that ever been the incentive for the United States government to stop spending money on useless things?
That's a great question, because I found something else that I thought was really funny, which I'll bring up later.
All right. So there were 7,200 mile per hour speeds recorded. This set the area on high alert, lasted about a week up until the 26th, when multiple reports of glowing aerial objects popped up all over the area, seen by eyewitnesses on the ground and also tracked on radar.
Should have rewrote that sentence a few times. A little rough, but...
Now, while accounts decreased over the next few months, they held on, with one major event of the 1952 flap being the September 12th events that were witnessed in multiple states, and of course, that of the monster. However, one of the most significant events, often unacknowledged, took place just 1.5 hours before the sighting of the Flatwoods Monster, and it happened over the Gulf of Mexico. There... A F-94C Starfire disappeared off the coast of Florida.
Wrong coastline.
Yeah, that's true. The plane was being piloted by John A. Jones Jr. That's the name of a person. And also occupied by a radar operator named John Del Curto. Now, the two were being tracked on radar when they simply disappeared. The pilot radioed around 5:52 p.m., stating that he was having engine trouble, and then that was it. No mayday, no ejector seats, nothing. What's more, it was reported that this was a training exercise, and thus monitored closely. The story was picked up and reported on, especially in Florida, over the next few days, in over 9 different publications. Now, this story is interesting because it was uncovered by one Frank Feschino. I don't know how to say it. I'm going to call him Frank. He was writing a book on the Flatwoods, also known as the Braxton County Monster, which was to be released in 2013, 7 years ago. Now, on a hunch, Frank decided to follow up with the base that the man flew out of, Maxwell, to see if anything ever came from the case. He was told that nothing ever came out of it because nothing ever happened. They had no record of such a disappearance occurring. Frank was dumbfounded.
Double cover-up.
You have no idea how deep this goes.
I mean, it sounds pretty surface level.
No, it's not. It's crazy. Frank was dumbfounded, double-checked his information, sent another letter including reference to the aforementioned newspaper articles, which laid it out very plainly who went missing and where they went missing from. But upon the second reply, Frank got a gut punch. The names which had been referenced by the newspaper articles, John A. Jones and John Del Curto, according to Maxwell Air Force Base, were never a part of the United States Army. In fact, the men didn't even show up in any government files whatsoever. No birth records, enlistment paper, death notices. There's nothing at all. In fact, other than the 9 newspaper articles that Frank had collected, there was no evidence that these men even existed. Until, through some good, honest distrust of the government and old-fashioned detective work, Frank was able to track down the family of both men, each of whom had a brother surviving that agreed to meet with him. Through these men, Feschino was able to obtain a number of vital documents, including the telegrams sent to the family by the Air Force offering their condolences on their family's loss. One telegram read that the area covered in the search was around 46,000 square miles. On October 23rd, a telegram was received by Ashby G. Jones, brother of John A. Jones, that his brother had officially been declared dead and the search for him was over. But why? Why cover this up?
Why is it connected to the Flatwoods Monster?
I'm so glad you asked.
I'm really confused why we're hanging out in Florida for so long.
The United States was, and maybe still is, at war with UFOs and their occupants. On the 29th of July, 1952, days after the peak of the Washington, D.C. flap, an article came from the International News Service claiming that the Air Force had instituted a 24-hour nationwide alert to chase any unidentified craft and shoot them down. According to Ruppelt, this order was in full swing by September, with him recalling at least one incident of a UFO being fired upon and destroyed outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico that month. Now, what Frank uncovered was that between 1951 and 1956, there were over 254 reports of fighter jets crashing with little to no explanation. Out of this group, 19 vanished with no wreckage or recovery. Many of the planes, especially the ones that completely disappeared, were piloted by some of the most skilled pilots that the Air Force had. And by comparison, during the Korean War, a 3-year-long conflict that involved aerial dogfighting on the regular, there were only 83 crashes in total. This led Frank to believe that the men in the Starfire were actively pursuing and attacking UFOs and then being counterattacked, as in this specific case. Even more damning evidence of this comes from the fact that General Benjamin W. Chidlaw, who was the commander of the U.S. Air Force during the disappearances over the Gulf of Mexico, and whose name was all over these telegrams sent to the lost men's family, made a statement to a journalist in 1953 when asked to comment on the seriousness of the flying saucer situation, saying, quote, "We have stacks of reports on flying saucers. We take them seriously when you consider we have lost many men and planes trying to intercept them," unquote. So, if we take all of this information, it creates an internally coherent account of the case. The sighting before and after the Flatwoods case are UFOs. It's worth noting that multiple Air Force bases scrambled jets in response to the lights above and around the six states that they were seen on the 12th, and that Flatwoods was officially, albeit quietly, investigated by the Air Force. Jones and Curto were not on a training mission, but rather a pursuit mission of seek and destroy, which went very wrong. Either they or another pilot in the air that night was able to get a shot off and wound a ship. That ship then crashed in Flatwoods, which, if it was going the max speeds as taken from the DC sightings, would have only taken 9 or 8 minutes to get to from the Gulf of Mexico up to West Virginia. Thus,
well, it has to turn around because it was,
and then go up,
yeah,
and around.
Yeah, it's
got to
be,
yes,
flipping around. Okay, gotcha. Just making sure.
The UFO crashed.
It's
and
funny
it,
how
it
no
had,
one saw it coming that
it
way,
had
huh?
Absolutely enough time for all of that. The UFO crashed or sustained a hit that still allowed it to navigate and was able to make a controlled landing. This is what the boys saw. When the group crested the hill, it's worth remembering that the monster did not seem to be headed towards them, but rather headed towards the craft, or the ball of fire, that was about 50 feet to their right. Now, the monster itself wasn't an alien, or maybe it was, but it was not biological, which
is
something very important.
This was reported much, much later. And only by one of the witnesses.
No, it was reported by two of the witnesses, at least.
All right. Sure.
Thank you.
But still, much, much later.
Ivan T. Sanderson's final analysis of the case rendered the verdict that the monster was not an occupant of the craft, but rather was the craft itself. It was being piloted externally.
But why was there another ball of light
off to
the right? These
are aliens! We don't know how they work! Maybe that was its power source and it fell out or something. I don't know. Just because it doesn't work how what we think it should work like doesn't mean it's not an alien.
I just mean that explanation leads me to other questions.
That's good. It's good to question.
Because it doesn't make sense.
Why don't you call Ivan T. Sanderson and have him tell
you about it? I would, but I need a Ouija board. That doesn't work.
Unless you want to believe it does, in which case you can get all of the answers.
You're right, because they come from me. I have all the answers.
You're right.
That I need.
You are absolutely right. You are what you seek. What you have wanted is inside of you this entire time.
Love?
Alchemy.
Oh, nice.
Sick. Now, Mrs. May would, years later, state that the thing was in fact a ship of some kind, which is what makes me really interested in this thing that you showed me. She claimed that it was a government rocket or something like that, because, in her honest opinion, the Bible don't say nothing about no UFOs, and therefore it couldn't have been a UFO. This is a popular take that some people have, and you're entitled to have that take. Now, she claimed that A. Lee Stewart, again, that publisher of the Braxton County Democrat, had some sort of notice from the government to that effect, that this was government property, something they were testing, although this document has never been confirmed or produced. And Fred May would tell Frank Fischino, quote, "It was mechanical. It wasn't alive. Maybe inside the thing there could have been something that was alive. But what I seen was either a small spaceship, or a suit of some kind. Something it was wearing. It was mechanical," unquote. Now, as Frank examined the initial reports given to the police and the press, he saw that this was consistent with those reports before they blew up and out of proportion added by the press. Just 5 days after the report came out, the perception was that it was a monster and not a machine. According to Frank, the reports of other orange lights in the area that evening were similar craft, circling in an attempt to find their falling cohort, and when they did, they landed to conceal and repair it. Then they departed the next morning, as described by the school board president. Now, Flatwoods has gone on to become many things. Like Jason says, it's in Fallout 76. I first came in contact with Flatwoods while playing The Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask.
Yeah, you did.
Where they are the creepiest thing in my entire life.
Yeah, they are.
I'm still traumatized by them. But it's been everywhere ever since.
In all their low-res glory.
Yeah, really. It's been everywhere ever since. And despite anything Jason might try to do here, we will never be rid of the legend of the Flatwoods Monster.
Oh, so it's my turn.
Go ahead, Jace.
All right, so the U.S. government did send in its own investigation, posing as two newspaper or magazine writers.
Okay.
They concluded that their sightings was an owl. The sicknesses described were caused by severe fright and hysteria. Otherwise, as far as planes go, now this is the fun bit. So I looked up, and because I was curious about how well a U.S. fighter would be able to have a dogfight, per se,
with a UFO.
With a UFO that can travel at basically almost Mach 7, like
speed.
Mach 6.5. And then I stumbled across an article about a test run on a fighter jet in 1957.
5 years later, okay.
Yep. That speed was Mach 1.1 is what is its top speed. Now, the pilot, during testing, fired off his cannons, and then, after a short time after that, went into a slight dive. His windshield, shortly after that, became impacted and concaved, and the plane itself actually took mortal damage to its engines. The pilot himself survived just fine. I believe he was able to land. What happened was that he was going so fast that he caught up to his bullets that got slowed down from the drag of air.
Amazing.
And he's going Mach 1.1.
Yeah.
He's not going Mach 6.5. So the likelihood of any of these things getting shot down by what we had at the time is hysterically maddening. It's borderline impossible.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is wild.
Which is why we have so many crashed Air Force jets, but no crashed UFOs.
Well, I think that, again, kind of goes to show that, like, again, things happen while testing that we didn't quite think about 100% of the time, which that incident does show as well.
Yeah.
But at that point in time, too, we don't have the type of instruments that we do now as far as keeping track of where we are. And that's the biggest thing with Bermuda, the Bermuda Triangle in general, which is why I bring it up again, is that instruments go haywire and get funky sometimes. And with how storms work in the coastline, especially in the Gulf of Mexico as well, is that things get haywire rather quickly if you're not keeping your wits about you perfectly.
Okay.
I mean, there's a test run of a pilot trainer and I believe like four or five other pilots off the coast of Florida that went missing because they got turned around and thought one part of Florida was actually a different part of Florida. And then they all just vanished.
Now, that's some Bermuda Triangle
so,
stuff.
Like that kind of mistakes happen, and that was pretty, I'm not going to say that common, but it's known to have occurred in this point in time, too.
All right.
So half of it's probably that, or at least a portion of it's probably that of getting mixed up in flight. And a lot of this doesn't actually have anything to do with our creature. None of the original descriptions described it as being metallic.
Well, I had to make this an hour-long episode, thank you.
You made it an hour and a half.
I did.
No one originally described it as being metallic. Some didn't even claim the body was colorless to some degree as well. Green was only two of the accounts. Talons were only originally posted by Mrs. May. And lastly, I'd like to share a little something with you, bud. Just a little something. That should just pop up. Do you not have AirDrop on? AirDrop.
No, it's on.
I don't know where this is going. There it is now. Accept.
Okay.
So, two things that I've noticed. Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, coming out in August 1952, has a large-eyed alien wearing a helmet that has a nice little point at the top.
That is very not a much month, like an Ace of Spades, thank you very much.
A month before.
It literally has a point at the top of it.
It does.
It's not...
It looks more like an old school kind of light bulb ish. The second one is a leak to a barn owl hissing, which is terrifying.
Oh my god.
Which, unless you knew that was a barn owl, I would expect that to be some sort of mechanical thing going after you. That does not sound natural, right? That sounds wild.
That is pretty bad. I hate that.
The second link that I have,
okay,
is a really interesting threat display.
Okay. Oh,
that won't. Owls also make. They also make this cool clicking noise with their beaks as well. Now, the owl I want to really point out is the one in the middle.
And of course, we'll link to this in the show notes so you can watch this too.
And the owl in the middle looks kind of like our head.
No, it doesn't.
It's positioning its feathers and its back of the body vertically.
No, that does not. That does not match the description. I don't believe.
But
so.
The sounds
are
pretty darn
maybe.
Good.
It wasn't a flippin' owl.
It was an owl.
I hate this show so much. I'm gonna burn it to the ground.
That's all I have
Fine.
To say about that.
All right, that's all you have to say about that. He says. Yes. All right. Well, that's all I have to say about it, too. I've presented the evidence to the court, Your Honor.
You have presented a version of the evidence.
Yes, and so have you.
Nope, I've just
given
examples and real information.
Yep, so have I. Lots of real information. Correlated and causated. All right, well, I think I'm about done with this.
I love it. That
in
was
general,
so much fun.
I mean, the
Did
the
you
show,
enjoy it?
Let's shut it down.
No, I had a blast.
Jason, you have a special next week.
Perfect.
What are you going to talk about?
Who knows?
That's what I was afraid of. I will...
Probably a cryptid.
Yeah, let's keep doing cryptids. I like
I was thinking, so scanning through, oh God, what's his face? Ivan T.
Sanderson.
Sanderson. He also popularized a Congo River spirit monster.
Hell
cryptid.
Yeah.
Potentially another Lost World-esque dino thing. So I might dig a little bit deeper into that if there's really anything substantial there.
Yeah, like living...
Of course, I'll
I know,
be reporting back.
I know living dinosaurs in general is
don't exist.
One.
I know. It's great.
But that is one that pretty much you've covered quite well in your lake
Extensively.
Monsters. Yeah, so...
Maybe. I'll fiddle around with some other things, too.
Okay.
I think it's going to be a blast either way.
And then... After that, we will be potentially...
I'm just here to make everyone angry at me.
Yeah, well, you're doing very well. After that, we will then potentially be in the Crowley zone for a while, or we may be just 1 to 2 more weeks out. It is truly, truly...
Have you done Thunderbirds? Have you done...
No,
have
I haven't.
Thought, have
and
you
I
thought
was,
about them?
I was thinking a lot about them as I was doing the Mothman accounts.
Right.
So that would be pretty good, actually.
Okay.
All right, Thunderbirds.
Maybe.
Maybe. And then we will be 1 to 2 weeks out from the Crowley zone where we will live for the remainder of our natural born lives. It is truly insane.
Am I going to become a lich?
Yes, you are.
I'm excited.
It's just crazy how much there is to all of this. So I'm about halfway done with the research. I am just going to keep going through it. So it's going to be great. All right. Well, you know where to find us. We're on Instagram now.
What?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes on Instagram.
Interesting.
Did you do it last week?
Yes.
Okay.
it was poignant. You're like, oh, that was actually
oh, it was
bad.
Good because yeah. you had time because we rock, paper, scissored.
Correct.
That's right. All right, well, remember, whether you are seven people and one dog marching up the hill to see the thing that came from somewhere else, or you are a sunburned Florida man rushing out of a thicket, machete held high, you are not alone.